be here, especially today at this time. I am holding a book in my hands, Judicial Fortitude, the last chance to rein in the administrative state, by Peter J. Wallison. I want to tell you something. Once you read this book, you will say, what has been going on? I thought that we elected people, sent them to Washington, and they were doing our work. They were making the thing happen. Well, evidently not. And you'll find out why, and let's meet our special, special guest. Peter, good morning, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Great to have you here, and I want to tell you something, and my partner, this book really says a lot, and I'm sure you are surprising many, many Americans.
Well, I hope so. That's why I wrote the book. It's important for people to understand what is happening.
Now, Peter, when you talk about the administrative state in the book, define that for the average person who might not be awash in this. When we hear the word that the administrative state has kind of taken over here or is out of control, what do you mean?
The administrative state is just a name for all of the federal agencies of the executive branch. There are hundreds and hundreds of them, and they range from, say, the cabinet officers, the cabinet agencies you hear about daily, like the Treasury Department or HHS, down to the independent agencies such as the SEC.
And I know
so,
that
it's the full range.
And I know that and we're hearing a lot of this now in the controversy surrounding Mr. Trump, the president, that we have a lot of career people, unelected officials in these agencies, Peter, that are wielding incredible power and oftentimes, you know, usurping the will of the people through our elected officials, correct?
Yes, that's exactly correct. It's turned out that they have much more of the power to make the rules that people live under than ought to be true in a democratic republic such as the United States.
Now, we're talking with Peter J. Wallison. Judicial Fortitude is the title of his book, The Last Chance to Rein in the Administrative State. Do you believe the reason that this did happen and has happened, because you can't compare it to when it all started in this country and they needed some help, it got larger and larger? Do you think that is one of the reasons? Do we need this, or don't we?
Well, here's what happened. Congress passes laws, and the laws have to be implemented by some organizations. The framers established a structure in which Congress would have the legal authority, and the executive would merely enforce the laws or execute the laws. What has happened over time, in part because of the way the courts have approached this, what's happened over time is that more and more power has gone to these administrative agencies made up of unelected people. And they have been given the opportunity to make choices, to create options, to decide policies that cover all of the American people. And these policies very often are the policies that are appreciated and liked by the people who live around Washington, D.C. These are their neighbors. But those policies are not necessarily those that the American people as a whole would approve.
Wow.
And what we have to do is get things back to a point where Congress is making the laws and the administrative agencies are enforcing the laws, but only the laws that Congress has passed. Only they'll use only the powers that Congress has actually given them.
You point out in the book, and again, the guest is Peter Wallace, and the book is called Judicial Fortitude. You point out in the book, Peter, one important case that you highlight. It's from 1984. It went to the Supreme Court. And I kind of remember this case. It was Chevron versus, I believe, the NRDC, the National Resources Defense Council. What is so key about that Supreme Court case in your argument here?
This is a very, very important case in that what the Supreme Court said to all of the lower courts was you should defer to the decisions of the agencies, the regulatory and administrative agencies, as to the powers that they have actually received from Congress. Congress issues statutes, makes statutes. The agencies then are empowered by those statutes. But the question is, how far does that power extend according to the words in the statute? And traditionally, the way the framers thought about it, the courts would decide that how far the powers of the executive went based on these statutes. But in 1984, in this very important case, the Supreme Court said to lower courts, no, no, the ones who have the power to interpret the statutes are the agencies themselves, and you should defer to their decisions if those decisions are reasonable.
So they changed.
That gave the agencies tremendous latitude to extend their powers beyond the actual words in the statute.
Did you ever read, what was their, I don't know whether you obviously have read some of the opinions of that case, what was their thinking in saying that, Peter? I mean, if you can break it down away from lawyer speak here, what was their thought process going on there?
Well, it really came out of some ideas that were developed in the late 1800s called the progressive movement in the late 1800s wanted many of the agencies, what wanted people in agencies who were disinterested, intelligent, and capable of managing the economy. And that idea came from the 1880s, 1890s, through the election of Wilson in 1912, up to the New Deal. That whole period had great faith in the ability of these very intelligent people to run the country, in effect. And that's why, in 1984, the same ideas kind of infected, if you will, the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court decided that it would be much better for the country, it would be much easier if we just allowed these very well-educated, credentialed, disinterested, smart people to make these decisions for us. That's got to stop.
But again, when you look at that and analyze that, the people that were elected were the people that these people knew, that these people trusted. And if they had something that they wanted to get done, it would get done. And what happened, and I think it's tremendous that you wrote this book, is to let people know today that that's not happening, and it isn't happening.
Right. It isn't happening. Now, the good news, as you know, I hope you know, is that with Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation to the Supreme Court, there are now five justices on the Supreme Court who are constitutionalists.
They
understand the way the Constitution was structured, they understand why it was structured that way, and they understand where the authority ought to be to make the rules.
There you go.
And I believe that they will be modifying this Chevron case accordingly.
Really? Wow.
When
wow.
the case comes to them. So that is the good news. This is a problem we have today, but it's important that people understand that it's on its way to being solved if the court does what I expect it to do. And the reason the book is called Judicial Fortitude is that when the court does these things, there will be a tremendous amount of blowback.
Oh, yeah, of course.
By the, especially by the left. And
they'll have time bombs going off.
Yeah, yeah, right. they'll send more fake bombs. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They want the decisions made by the administrators in Washington, because those are the kinds of policies they like, not necessarily the policies that the people of the United States would vote for.
The name of the book is Judicial Fortitude. Our guest, Peter J. Wallace. And Peter, you mentioned here that Alexander Hamilton, one of the founders, called the judiciary the guardian of the Constitution, but it's your opinion they have failed, and we can see what you're arguing here. Here's the question. Why? Was it a lack of fortitude, which we could phrase as other things we won't throw this morning, or was it just pure partisan politics on members of the judiciary? Why did they fail?
Well, I think it goes back to what happened in the New Deal. There was always this sense in among some judges that Congress was providing too much power to the regulatory agencies, that was inconsistent with the Constitution. And in 1935, in two cases, the Supreme Court decided to strike down two laws on the grounds that they provided the president with too much power. The next year, in an election, 1936, FDR won a huge victory, an overwhelming victory, and he retaliated against the court and threatened to appoint 7 new justices, make the court then.
I remember that.
He wanted to pack the court. Yeah, this is the classic Roosevelt wanting to pack the court. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. Now, that was not successful. The people didn't like that, and it didn't pass Congress, but it scared the court. And after that, in addition, a lot of the members just started resigning. And Roosevelt, between 1937 and 1941, appointed almost all the members of the court. He appointed about 7 members of the court, plus a chief justice. And so all those people who he appointed were people who had grown up in the progressive era and also supported the idea of very many, a lot of the power being concentrated among the administrative agencies, where they thought the really intelligent, credentialed, disinterested people would run the government. So now you're seeing how that connects to the decision in 1984, the Chevron decision. Same legal principles, same ideas coming up as far as 1984 and being hardened into an actual decision that allowed these agencies to have so much latitude. But it's a long process, and now we're in a position where a different attitude toward the administrative agencies dominates the Supreme Court, and they have to have the fortitude to stand up to the groups in Congress and in the presidency who want to maintain that power. And that's why judicial fortitude is necessary now, as it was over the 200 years when it was not exercised appropriately.
Peter, I got to ask you. You interviewed my favorite president. And you know who I'm talking about, Ronald Reagan, the power of conviction and the success of his presidency.
Right.
What was he like?
Oh, well, Ronald Reagan was one of the most extraordinary individuals, of course, anyone could have met. But the thing that you would most appreciate about him was his an enormous respect for every individual he met, whether that person was someone who was cleaning his room, the Oval Office, or helping him in the hospital, or what I was, his counsel. or a person who was a member of his cabinet. Ronald Reagan respected everyone. He would never raise his voice with anyone. He was very calm, always ready to listen, and always respectful of what people said to him. He was a remarkable person. And that's why he was such an effective president, because the people saw that somehow. They sensed that in what they saw on television or heard on the radio. So he was a truly remarkable guy.
Peter J. Wallison, the book, Judicial Fortitude. And Peter, on behalf of my buddy over here, who's with me in the morning, I want to thank you so much for giving us the time. The book was fascinating, and I consider it an honor to have you with the two of us here on our radio program here this morning.
Well, thank you. It's my honor, actually, and I do appreciate your inviting me.
Thank you, Peter. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
Okay.